test. I said to the doctor, it was Dr. Ronnie Jackson, I said, is there some kind of a test, an acuity test? And he said, there actually is, and he named it, whatever it might be. And it was 30 or 35 questions. The first questions are very easy. The last questions are much more difficult, like a memory question. It's like you'll go person, woman, man, camera, TV. So they say, could you repeat that? So I said, yeah. So it's person, woman, man, camera, TV. Okay, that's very good. If you get it in order, you get extra points. If you, okay, now he's asking you other questions, and then 10 minutes, 15, 20 minutes later, they say, remember the first question? Not the first, but the 10th question? Give us that again. Can you do that again? And you go, person, woman, man, camera, TV. If you get it in order, you get extra points.
All right, welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to episode 20 of Soft Revolution. My name is Ali Momin.
I am Jennifer Lena.
Oh, that's right. Jennifer Lena Torkel is not with us right now because he is going all the way from Quebec to Vancouver. But you know what? Good for us because Jen's back.
Woo!
Guess who's back? Back again. How you doing?
I am holding in there. It is hot as blazes as New York City, and we are very concerned that soon there are going to be military police on the street. But you know what? We are up to the challenge.
You know what? You guys have been through a lot. New York City is like a very resilient city. It's like you guys just like go for it. You brush it off, you know, dirt off your shoulder. You know, it's all good with you guys. You guys are quite resilient, quite resilient.
You know, it's a city of immigrants. We get the job done.
Oh, see, I went Jay-Z, you went Lin-Manuel. I like it. I like it. I like it. I like it. Okay, you know what? We have an amazing show today. Obviously, you know, Jen's on the show, so no matter what happens, the show is going to be amazing.
Woo!
But we are talking, yeah, that's right. We are talking to Nick Duckart and Marianne Torres. They're husband and wife. And Nick actually played Kevin Jay on in Come From Away on the tour. And Marianne was playing Elphaba on tour of Wicked. And the two of them, obviously, coronavirus. And now they are in all, of all places, Miami. So, you know, we had an amazing talk with them. And I think by the end of it, they may have a podcast of their own. But they are just an amazing, amazing couple. Like, I wish they were. You know, it's like how I feel with you, Jen. Every time I hang out with you, I'm like, this is bullshit. Where's the wine? Why isn't Jen here?
I feel the same way, man. I mean, my life is so international. I'm so lucky that it is. I've worked really hard to make it so. And I just miss my people all over the world. And I miss feeling like I'm a part of that bigger world. So I feel you.
So are you someone who, you know, if it wasn't because of this, like you'd be just traveling? Like where would you, if this shit show wasn't happening, like where do you think you'd be?
So my canceled plans include...
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Yeah. So I was on a book tour when this all hit. And so I missed the opportunity to go to Abu Dhabi. I was going to go to Istanbul. I had a trip to Berlin. I had a trip to London. And then this summer was supposed to be a chance for me to be off the road a little bit for work and on the road to be able to see family. Because as my life has taken shape over the last couple of years, I really haven't been able to do too much like vacation in the strictest sense. So I was looking forward to seeing, I've got family from West Coast to East Coast, and I was kind of hoping I would see them, but some other year.
2024, that's what I say. About everything.
Yeah. I mean,
no,
you
it's
know,
good because,
inshallah.
You know, it's going to be before. Yeah. Inshallah. Yeah. Of course. Of course. Yeah. That's like my mom tells me all the time. She's like, Ali, don't worry. Inshallah. I'm like, you know what, mom? You're the best. So we got a bunch of things that we want to talk about. But actually, first thing I want to talk about is an op-ed by Jennifer C. Lena.
I know her.
Yeah, I think I know her too. And the title of the op-ed is called Fund Artists, Not Organizations. And Jen has put it up on her Medium, which is like a blogging platform or an article distribution platform. It's on the internet. We're going to have it in the show notes. But can you talk about, give us the kind of like the Coles notes about what you argue in this op-ed? And then I have a couple things I want to talk about in respect to it.
Yeah. So the op-ed reflects our conversation. I think it came out of that first time that I visited all of you and was making this argument about why the lessons of the New Deal could be relevant today. And so basically in the op-ed, I describe, you know, the brief highlights of what the program was. And what's important there is that it was a jobs program. And from that, we can see the potential of funding individual artists through a jobs program. And I argue that that's a better system for some of the outcomes that we want to see than the practice that we have now, which is to send what money we do have available for the arts primarily to large organizations, you know, big museums, big symphony orchestras. And my argument isn't that we shouldn't be supporting organizations, but rather that when we fund individual artists, we get two really good outcomes. We get more people entering this field as artists. We get more people paid for what they do. And then the second outcome of that is that we get more variety in what gets made. The more and more different kinds of people that you include, the more and more different kinds of things that they can make. And so I argue that, you know, if we can get some money in the form of a jobs program to artists, we could see the same incredible flowering of creativity and community engagement that we saw in the wake of the WPA. And that would do worlds of good to start healing some of the very deep wounds that are a function of sexism, racism, and the associated kind of institutional evils. So that's the basic argument.
So why do you think that's the case? Why do you think it goes to organizations and not directly to artists?
Yeah, so this is, I'm going to really resist the temptation to teach the first session of my cultural policy class right now.
Hey,
squarely in the territory of what I teach all the time. You know, different countries have designed different ways of getting funds to the arts and artists. All countries do it in one way or the other. And in the US, we've just adopted this very privatized model. So we really don't spend much money at all on the arts. It's such a small percentage of the layout of federal dollars. It's less than a dollar what each individual American contributes through their taxes. And that money doesn't go to individual artists anymore because we had a very successful conservative campaign against the arts in the 80s. You might have heard of Robert Mapplethorpe. He's a photographer. He's now dead, unfortunately. He was a photographer whose work included lots of different portrait subjects. But he had a specific exhibit that was actually shown at an arts organization in the South that had photographs of men engaged in various kinds of sexual activity. And the Congress went after the NEA charges of, you know, this material.
The National Endowment of the Arts, yeah.
National Endowment of the Arts, our federal agency that governs this sort of thing. Disperses money. And the response of the Democrats at the time was to say, like, okay, we don't really want to find ourselves defending, you know, there's a bullwhip up this man's anus, right? We don't want to say that this is art. We're going to back off of that. And the way that we're going to do it is we're going to eliminate individual grants to artists and basically set up organizations as this like buffer zone. So that the organizations get the money and then they can redistribute it to artists. And it just creates this layer of protection between artists and the government. It hasn't
functioned.
And
so they're not responsible for whatever.
Yeah. And it hasn't functioned that way. Like, it hasn't actually protected artists from charges of these kinds. There's still enormous numbers of books that are banned and art that can't be shown and artists whose careers have been ended. Yeah. Well, there are places in this country that you cannot perform the vagina monologues. Like I don't know.
By law or like people pick it?
Right. Like school boards say, not on our watch.
Wow.
Yeah. Even Catholic colleges and universities have prevented student groups from showing that play, from doing that play on campus.
Oy. Well, you know, it's crazy. I'm reading here. It's actually 47.4 cents per capita the U.S. pays for the arts. Germany, $85. Crazy. But this is what I don't understand, because obviously I'm looking at the WPA and going like, wow, look what America did. And that's why I'm confused as to where America is.
I mean, I think that the core problem that we need to contend with in building the America that exists in our imagination is privatization. And that's the most elegant answer I can give to you. I mean,
right.
What they basically said to us is, well, we'll let the market decide what culture should survive. And then there were powerful advocates for those large organizations. So they sort of protected them to a greater extent than anybody else could from that privatization. But they still, you know, so today the American Association of Museums released a report indicating that it's likely that one of every three nonprofit arts and cultural organizations are going to close as a result of COVID. Now, let's keep in mind that that includes like historical homes. It's a wider range than just like the narrow arts. But, you know, the reason that's the case is that even though government money does go to the arts, it's so small in its total amount that these organizations actually survive on the basis of like their cafes and their bookshops. Their, wow. The technical term is their earned income. And so because those places aren't open right now, it's a major contributing factor to these organizations looking at their books and saying, well, even the large ones don't operate with more than a year of reserve capital. So, you know, of course the small ones are going to go under if their bookshop is closed. By the way, like this also gets me this other thing, which, you know, for a while it was very in vogue to look askance at these, you know, quote unquote extras that were being built into arts organizations like space rentals and, you know, coffee like, shops and restaurants,
whatever,
all the rest of it. Everybody for a while, all of the people would turn up their noses at this, like, you know, terrible destruction that's being done. Well, those are the things that are keeping these people in business. Like, you know,
I also think it's really cool to have the theater and have an amazing restaurant that's adjacent or attached to the theater, because sometimes people don't go for the theater. They go for the steak and they say, hey, I'm here for the steak. Let me see the show. You know, well, it just brings people together. I don't know. I like it.
I know, but that's the reason that's the same evidence the critics cite for why it should go away. Like it's a distraction.
Snobbery. That's snobbery.
I think it's a very narrow-minded notion of why people like culture. And I think it's, you know, really important that what's the expression used with kids? Don't yuck my yum. I think it's really important that we reintroduce that concept into adult living because, you know, like my love of Celine Dion supports your ability to love some indie artist that you love. And so we need to see each other as like collaborators in this fight. If Celine Dion goes away, I don't know why I'm picking her, it's sort of arbitrary, but maybe it's a nod to your Canadian listeners.
Yeah.
You know, if we fail to protect the system that allows Celine Dion to thrive, we fail to protect the system that helps the independent artist, and the reverse is true. So we've really got to get out of the business of like disliking other people's culture and instead see it as an ecosystem where the all of it is in dialogue with each other.
Well, you're all for it in your op-ed. I mean, you literally say, to be sure, programs like these produce more artistic failures than hits, but you're generally saying that overproduction is a really good thing. That it's just let it happen as much as you can even imagine.
Well, and you guys know this, right? Like when you think about, you know, all of the scripts that are produced for TV pilot season, for, you know, play development seasons, for demos for record labels, like there is a metric ton of that stuff that's generated all the time. And as much as we think of like just the superstars, the truth is that those companies buy material from all different kinds of artists. And the business model is like, if 30% of the stuff that we sign makes a profit, then we're good. If 10% of what we sign makes a profit, then we're good. So if, you know, Columbia, CBS Records, if Sony, Time Warner, if their business, their for-profit business model is to accept a 90% failure rate, can we at least offer that same amount of latitude to non-commercial artists?
Mm-hmm.
Like, let's just get a huge system of production going. And you know, the other thing about that is that as much as we like to think that we know a hit when we hear it, like, oh, if I was in the room when they did Hamilton the first time, I also would have known it was going to be a genius production. There is plenty of evidence that is the exception, not the rule. Lots of stuff.
People who didn't invest in Hamilton. I know people who didn't invest in Hamilton, and I know these people hate themselves, but that is true.
That's because it's guesswork. You know,
it's a shit show.
The audience is complicated. And as much as people spend their lives trying to accurately predict what's going to be a hit, nobody does it in with perfection. So even more reason that we want to overproduce culture, because there are gems in there that we are never seeing and never hearing and never listening to or observing on a stage or reading in a book, because we don't have systems that allow us to overproduce in the nonprofits, mm-hmm. in the art side of the world.
Hey, can you tell me if this is true? Jen, I was reading another piece. This was in The Cut. It was by Misha Burson, who was the theater critic of the Seattle Times. But she was talking about that in the WPA. I know you mentioned Orson Welles did that all-Black production of Macbeth. Yeah. I love a podcast that I could say Macbeth. I don't have to say Scottish play. I don't have to, like, you know, Jesus, don't get me started with that. Like, you can't say that shit in front of people. Anyways, Macbeth, the play. So he did that. And then she was mentioning Arthur Miller got a WPA project, Langston Hughes, Jackson Pollock, Mark Rothko. But she was inferring in a way that this was at a time basically when Arthur Miller was an Arthur Miller, Orson Welles was an Orson Welles, Jackson Pollock was in Jackson Pollock. So is this true? Like, yeah. Were these... So, okay, because this is the thing that I think about, and I want to know what you think on this. I really think one of the biggest fears that I have is that if we cannot actually produce work for money and do it properly, there's going to be a mass exodus of talent. People are going to leave this business. They just will. It's like Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You have to survive. And I just wonder how many current kind of Langston Hughes, Arthur Millers, Mark Rothko's, Jackson Pollock's. By the way, what obviously can you give me some women who thrived? Because right now I'm just talking about some white men and I don't like it.
So Dorothea Lange, there's a white lady. You may know her Migrant series, the photographs that she took for the Farm Security Administration. There's that beautiful one of the woman. It's called Migrant Woman, I think, holding her child on her chest. Now you're going to, now that I'm being, the quizzes I always blank on. I'll get you some more names in a moment. So yeah, so your point is that we're going to be losing out on opportunities.
Like they're not going to do it. And do you think that's the case, Jen? Do you really think, if work isn't given to these people, do you think an artist just makes art, or do you think they need to make a living doing it?
I'm not really gonna humor that question with an answer. It's just obvious, right?
But not a lot of people think that, Jen. Not a lot of people outside the arts think that. No matter what we do, no matter what, you know, they think it's for joy or something. But the WPA really allowed future voices to sing when they couldn't, correct?
Absolutely. I want to say Dorothy West, now that I've had a moment to collect my brain. She was a writer. She was a writer at the same time as Zora Neale Hurston, writing very similar kinds of work as part of the Harlem Renaissance. And she got a WPA grant alongside Richard Wright and Ralph Ellison, African-American woman. Mary Kellogg Rice. These were great people who have not been sort of surfaced in history, in part because they're women and some of them are not white, but yes. So there's my answer to your women question. And the, do artists need to eat things? So really there are people who think that, so here's part of the reason I think that that illogical opinion persists. When most artists work, they are not included in the credits for that work, because most artists are what you would say backstage, right? They're camera operators, they're set designers, they're graphic designers, they're people who are like seamstresses who work, like really highly talented seamstresses who are actually producing the garments for all of your favorite high-end designers. There is this enormous, it's like the arts are the proverbial iceberg where we only see the tip on the top of the, above the waterline, but the majority of the structure is below it. So I think because so much artistic work is literally invisible, that we forget how many people are employed in the arts, and we forget how much skill and different kinds of skill are involved. And instead, we think of the tip of the iceberg, which tends to be these, you know, Kanye Wests and these Jeff Koons's, these, forgive me for saying, Lin-Manuel Miranda's. And those folks appear to us to be being paid fairly for their labor. Now, I would argue that even those folks are not being paid fairly for their labor, but I think that this is part of what promotes this kind of ignorance, is that we forget the stuff that's under the waterline. Mm-hmm. Is that your sense too?
Yeah, that is absolutely my sense. And I've awakened to that, this experience. Just, I think I even kind of lost sight of that. But it's only when the industry, it was only until the industry had to fall, the entire industry, not just the you know, the magic show. But when that fell, I started to see the pieces on the floor, and I started to see the seamstress, the wardrobe, everything that connected, and everything, all the jobs and the actual kind of, like, people ask me all the time, is like, oh, what do you miss? It's like, you know, I don't really miss the poetry. I miss the prose. And that's all the prose that you're talking about.
I'm curious about what your explanation for this is, why people persist in thinking the arts are just an avocation, not a vocation. I'm wondering if it's also the case that, like, the reduction of investment in arts in schools, and the fact that what little arts remain in the schools is mostly about arts appreciation and some amateur production, meaning, like, at least in the United States, it's very hard for kids to get exposure to the arts in an academic sense in middle or high school. And if they do, it's not a pre-professional education. So it's not linked with this is a possible career. While you probably will get this is a possible career from your biology class or from your social studies class, certainly from your English classes, your literature classes, you understand, well, I could grow up and be a writer, and I have some sense of what that might be like. And maybe my instructor even talks about the practice involved in production, or we do some of that practice production ourselves. And that's just, I think maybe as we've withdrawn support for that childhood exposure to the arts and oriented away from professional preparation and towards this kind of, like, the arts will make your life more beautiful all through your life, that might be encouraging it too.
Totally. That absolutely makes sense. And I always think of that, the child who learns the arts, and I've mentioned this before, where it doesn't really matter whether or not they go in, as they get older, whether or not they go into that conventional thing that you would assume an artist. Why do you think that happened? Like, honestly, why do you think that happened? Is it just because of funding that wasn't really available? Obviously, I could think of, like, phys ed as something that's been kind of disregarded in education. But why do they not teach the arts? Because it's so interesting as a kid. What do you do when they're babies and stuff? All they want to do is draw, paint. They want to sing. They want to dance. And they want to do all these things. They want to express artistically. And then all of a sudden, they show up in the institution of education, of school. And it's like, no, don't do that.
Yeah. I mean, there are lots of reasons, and it might be a really great thing to bring on somebody who is an expert in education systems in Canada, who can really speak to that with more granular detail. But I can tell you that, you know, at least here, the argument was that Americans were underperforming compared to other countries when it came to things like math and science knowledge. And so there was a big investment in, and there was also a bunch of, you know, jobs forecasting going on, saying, well, the future is going to be in generating a lot of these, you know, intellectual workers, quote unquote. And, you know, it seems that we took this poverty mindset. You know, the simple fact is, whenever I hear the, like, anybody making a there's not enough money for that, how are you going to pay for it argument, there is enough money in this world to remove everybody from poverty, to make sure that everybody has access to clean water, to make sure that everybody has a comprehensive education. There is not, in fact, a deficit of money in this world. The issue is that we do not have systems that provide that money to everyone. That's it. There's no reasonable person who can say there's not enough money to do what we think should be done with our kids.
So true. Dropping bombs. That's what you do.
Is
it? You just said that. I'm like, oh yeah, I'm gonna clip that clip. I'm gonna make it viral. Okay, Jen, serious conversation. Mm. We've spoken about this. People who listen to the show know that you have studied rap music. Okay. Now, and you've told me, you've warned me, because I warned you, I told you I want to ask you about this. And you're like, I just want you to know that I'm not keeping up on all the hip hop and the rap currently. However, okay, get me through this. Drop a bomb for me. Get me past my guilt. Should I be enjoying some of the hip hop I'm listening to? Hip hop that is, this is mainstream stuff. Highly misogynistic. Women referred to as B-I-T-C-H. Is there going to be a reckoning? Is it going to change? What do you think?
So I think that we got to kind of unpack. You've given a really good brief here for us to talk about. And we got to unpack a couple different components of it. You said the word should. And so we should try to figure out how we make should decisions, like what's the basis of it. And I'm not sure if there's a general principle that sounds like, you know, things that we struggle with within our own moral universe. And then there's like the guilt that's associated with that. Like, is guilt the right response when you, or the response you want to have when you run into something that you ask this question about? And then there's the like, what is objectionable question and whether there are any guidelines that we could talk about for that. Let's do that last piece first. So, you know, rap and hip hop is a very large universe. It is the most popular style of music on the planet, full stop. So it contains multitudes. There is a kind of rap for every kind of listener, whether you're somebody who prefers more of like a classical music style, if you want rap music that sounds like other pop music, if you want stuff that sounds very much like a hybrid with another form of music, like it's almost like pornography in that sense. If you can imagine it, it exists. So there's no deficit of stuff that will appeal to any particular set of moral values. So the should is like more, that transforms the should question into a, have I done all that I need to do to find the rap music that matches my moral values? And it sounds like maybe there's an opportunity there for you. Maybe there's more stuff that you haven't run into that you would really love and that wouldn't pose this problem for you. But
this is something that's very popular. Like I'm speaking about the very, very popular rap. I'm familiar, you know, there is conscious hip hop, and it's lately I've been listening to this woman Rapsody, who is incredible. And I think if you know, you're into hip hop, you like hip hop, you listen to her. She's very, 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 it's wonderful, and you could feel really good about it. But I'm just thinking about the stuff that I think we don't really pay attention to, and we're like dancing around to. Well, not really now these days, but that we're just dancing to and listening to songs that are just like number one, number two on the charts. And when you listen to it, it's like there was this Young T song that I listened to, and literally he was speaking. It's weird, but he was like, you know, this woman is basically giving me, you know, fellatio as if she owes me something. And you're just kind of like, whoa, hold on. Why am I bumping into this right now? You know?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think, okay. So I think that rap music is art, and like any kind of art, there is a real value in listening to points of view that you don't hold. So I would say, I would defend the need for, you know, rap music that's offensive, and the need for all of us to listen to stuff that offends us, just on this one basis alone. But, you know, so the popularity of some of this stuff, let me take you back, actually, for the sake of discussion, let me take you back, yes, to like 1986, 1987, 1988. This is the moment when we get Ice-T's Six in the Morning, which some people would say is the first quote-unquote gangster rap song. We get the emergence of Public Enemy on the East Coast, and soon thereafter NWA on the West Coast. And it sort of kicks off what we then would call the gangster rap moment. And boy, was there ever controversy about the content of the lyrics and even the music in that era, right? So very similar kind of situation. And it was also about misogyny. It was also about aggression towards police and threats of police violence. It was also about like these very florid tales of inner city violence that some in the Black community felt strongly were antisocial messages. Like, we shouldn't be promoting this notion that there's Black on Black crime. We should instead be saying the crime is the crime of the state against us. And the truth is that a lot of those lyrics were about both the activities that people were seeing in their neighborhoods and about the distortion and transformation of those activities through the lens of the state. So a lot of that stuff that sounds in one register like it's very, you know, adolescent, very violent, very misogynistic, there is another level of interpretation that's possible. In the same way that we don't treat, you know, songs by rock artists as literal descriptions of someone's opinions or someone's attitudes, we're able to understand that people adopt a narrator persona or a protagonist that's not themselves and speak from that person's point of view in order to illuminate something, to produce an emotional effect. That's true in rap music as well. So I'm obviously not endorsing, you know, that I'm not supporting the notion that we should make wildly misogynistic music popular, but I am saying that before we make a decision about what a song means, it's worth kind of considering it from other people's points of view, maybe points of view that are very different from your own, and to see if there might be some alternative interpretation there, some other kind of content that's being passed along. And those words are being used to get your attention, to inflame your emotion. Exactly.
I always say, you know, hip hop, you know, just to talk about, Kanye for a second. First of all, I do want to make I want to say one quick thing about Kanye, because this is my podcast and I'm going to say it. I lost my best friend to bipolar disorder. Yes, what Kanye's saying, you know, about Harriet Tubman, that's just stupid. Okay, stupid. But anyone who has experienced bipolar disorder knows exactly what's happening to Kanye, and I just want to say I wish him all the best. I really wish for his health. And you know, the thing about Kanye is interesting. It's like, sometimes I wish I could just go to him and say, man, you've done so much. It's okay. It's okay. You know, you don't have to constantly be Mr. Creative Genius, because the thing about the bipolar is that, you know, when they go to that place, it's intoxicating, and there's that freedom is, yes, it's very dangerous, but there's a lot there. And I have this suspicion, just like my best friend did, that he thinks that's the source. That's the only place he can find his greatness. And I just wish I could tell Kanye that no, you're great. You're Kanye, motherfucking West.
I wish telling him would make a difference, but of course that's not how the disease works
That's not how it works. But he says, you know, he goes, I think he said once, he goes, I'm id. Mm-hmm. I'm Freudian. This is what this is. Like, the reason why you love listening to me saying literally I am a god is that there's a part of you that says I am a god, and maybe doesn't speak itself, maybe doesn't scream itself, but it's there. And you know, you don't have to, yeah, it's like sometimes it's, you like feeling like Kanye West. So it's about a feeling as opposed to a literal thing. But then I start to sound like, you know, the thing they say about Trump, like, you know, take him seriously, don't take him literally. But I think, you know, you could apply that to hip hop.
Yeah, actually, I was just about to loop back and say, you know, that same principle applies to the music that you don't like hearing. I mean, let me just take the rapper that you're talking about and the use of the word bitch. I mean, that's not, hip hop didn't invent bitch as an invective. You know, that notion of cisgender dominant masculinity and its link up with misogyny, that's the culture. That's the culture we live in. That's the culture that rap artists live in also. And so we might dislike it when it's made explicit to us in this means, and then we all dance to it. But we are dancing to it when we're not listening to music also. That's just the structure of the world we live in.
Mm. Yes.
Well, I mean, you know, it just doesn't make sense to blame artists when they reflect our culture back to us as if they invented that culture. It's like, that's illogical.
Yeah, it's all systemic. It's there, you know, it's an expression of what they know.
And if you spend 3 seconds watching what adolescent boy culture looks like these days, that like, you know, she gave me a blowjob, like she owed me something. That's a lot of what's out there circulating in the culture. So, yeah.
But what I'm hearing is that it is, again, like I'm not, you know, I'm for free speech. I totally get it. Like it's all good. But I was reading also how like porn is affecting young men. And this also comes to the, you know, it isn't just simple that porn does X. I think it's like a systemic thing. I think it's lack of proper sex education. I think it's parenting that has kind of gone awry and not giving the proper information. But young women now are like, this is an aside, but young women now, they're going to their doctors with like anal fissures, you know, because boys are watching what they watch and they think that they could do whatever they want. Young men listening, that's not lovemaking.
Don't hurt your partner. I really want to recommend this book called Sexual Citizens by my friends Jennifer Hirsch and Seamus Khan. It's really important reading for anybody who's thinking about if you've got kids and you're trying to raise your kids to have healthy attitudes about sex. It's great for teachers, for college. It's based on research that was conducted at Columbia, a survey, observation, like 3 years of ethnographic work. It's really, really carefully done social science research. And it produced like the most alarming insights. For example, all of the African-American women that they talked to had experienced some form of sexual assault or sexual violence.
Ugh.
100%. We're having a lightning storm.
But that the timing of that though,
I'm so sorry. I can re-say it if you want me to.
No, we're keeping that in. I thought maybe I hit like an effect button or something. It's like, yeah. So, but you know what? If you say that point again, like 100% of all African American women they spoke to had sexual assault.
Yeah, exactly. And it should, that should be like, you know, that should alarm everyone so that they stand up, walk out of their houses and fix it immediately. And they have a lot of good arguments about why that's happening. And the exposure to pornography is part of it, but it's not exclusively it. And it's really important as we're thinking about kids going back to college, younger kids going to residential school environments, if any of that happens. You know, the way that these spaces are set up really encourages sexual violence and sexual assault.
Wowza. Okay, Jen, I don't want to keep you forever, but I'm going to ask you a big question. It's not really in the mandate of the podcast, but I love talking about it. What the fuck is happening in America? This is, you know, I have fought ever since. I'll never forget. I don't know. I was a young kid, and it was the 2000 election. And I remember it was, you know, the hanging chat and all that stuff, sitting there watching that happen. And I was like, wow, this country is so exciting. But this is wild what's happening right now. Yeah. Is there any precedent for this? I know people say 1968, but this smells different.
Yeah, no, I don't. I think that I saw a deck that one of these kind of politics forecasters put out, and they were also comparing it to 68. And I mean, I don't know. I talked to my folks about this. They were in college in 1968, and they also failed to see the parallels. But, you know, that's like a kind of a technical political science history question. You're asking me like a citizen on the street response about what's going on.
Like, how do you feel? How does this feel?
It feels exactly the way that it is. We live in a dictatorship. It feels like, I sit here wondering if Trump. So I saw some video today of a train delivering large military vehicles from some base in Wisconsin down to Chicago. And it's a video of an invasion by our own citizens. So I think it's really scary. It's combined with the economic collapse and high rate of unemployment, I have to say, it looks to me like a recipe for serious urban disorder. As if it weren't scary already, people dying from this illness, as if it wasn't scary already, people's housing and healthcare and their food in jeopardy as a result of the economic collapse. The idea that then we would add violence on top of that, like real civil violence, not this bullshit, like there are marauding Antifa, insurgents in all of our cities, like that's clearly been debunked as a false narrative. But this would be real. Like it really is terrifying to consider that there would be, my neighbors would be armed and standing in front of me, telling me to go home or arresting me and putting me into a van. It's terrifying. And, the other thing is that the folks like me who I've spent my life teaching about social stratification, about discrimination. I've been out and loud about my feminism, about my anti-racism, about my support for Palestine. And this means that I'm on a relatively short list of people that pose a danger to the state. And so just on an individual level, I think, that the world that we live in now is one in which there might be a future podcast that I can't participate in because I'm imprisoned. And I don't know that we have systems set up to prevent that from happening. I don't know that we have a civil society that's robust enough right now that anyone could realistically protect me or anyone in my situation, including you. You're in the situation too. Mm-hmm. Of course, you're in a better country.
Right. Do you think this ends with Trump? Look, I mean, I think we were all wrong in 2016. We all thought, it'd be different. But Joe Biden wins. He wins, let's say, 350 plus electoral votes. Does this change, really?
I want so much to be an optimistic guest for you. I think we have really hard work to do and it's going to take generations. So will it change eventually? I hope so. I hope that we can kind of arc history in that direction. But right now is a hard time for me to have optimism about that because we're not at the leading edge of anything yet. Like it gets much worse from here before we're in any position to think about what it looks like when it gets better. So it's hard to say. I mean, I have to say that these predictions are inherently flawed, right? Like I certainly, when I was a kid, I thought to myself, well, I will definitely never be president because I'm a woman and no person of color will ever be president. And one of those things has changed. So, maybe these things that seem impossible can suddenly become possible in a short order of time when we all kind of get back to first principles. I was watching this documentary about a screenwriter, the guy who wrote Apocalypse Now. He wrote a bunch of famous kind of cowboy films and stuff. He was thought of as a real like man's man. In fact, I think there's one of the talking heads is on there saying he wrote for men because he was a man. He didn't write. Actually, I think the line was he didn't write for wussies and he didn't write for women. He wrote for men because he was a man's man. I know. But, I think like that is now an impossible position for a screenwriter. We've created a situation in which that is not socially desirable. And we've done that in the 30 years between when he was active and now. So I'd like to think if we could get back to first principles and just think like, what are the foundations of what make us a community? What are the things that we all share as community values? And I wish the discourse could focus on that as much as we're focusing on what divides us, because it's that other narrative that's going to get us out of this. The kind of resilience of Americans. You were talking about the resilience of New Yorkers before, but Americans are incredibly resilient. We have recovered from unimaginable challenges to our life and our liberty, to our ability to thrive. There's no reason to think we can't do it again. We've also thrived as people who sort of help one another. The mutual assistance that's built into the fabric of this country, it should still be there. And if we could just tap into that a little bit and think, how can I help someone instead of how can I tell someone the ways that they're wrong? I don't know. I believe that there's power in that.
I do believe it too, but it's okay, you know, to recognize just, you know, what's in front of us right now, but also to recognize, you know, all the things that we've done and all the things that we're capable of. And America always has this ability to surprise us, and even to surprise, it seems like, you know, you, as you were talking about. So there's hope there.
I think there is too. I think that it's a really, really beautiful place. I feel this way about Canada too. I'm not upvoting Canada just because I'm answering your question, but this is not to say that there's anything wrong with Canadians or that you lack any of these qualities. You have them all in spades.
Ah, thank you.
I believe in you guys. I need Canada to lead right now. I need Canada to bring this continent into the future. I need you guys to get behind the fact that there is a question of human dignity at stake here. And we've really just got to find our common humanity and all put our best foot forward, do what we can to go into the next couple of decades with one another's well-being foremost in our minds.
I love that. And I could really see that kind of happening because we're cognizant of the fact that, you know, America is in a way asleep, or as I say, kind of in a nightmare, not really asleep, but I could really see that, you know, Canada, Germany, New Zealand, Australia, Vietnam, Taiwan, like all these, many of those countries run by women, by the way, really kind of like propelling forward and hopefully maintaining the balance of, you know, liberty and justice and freedom and all that good stuff. So we got you.
I hope so. I believe in you.
Justin, Justin's got you. Justin's holding you in his arms right now. He's looking in your eyes.
I would just be happy if Justin had a job for me. I would be really happy to use my expertise to help the Canadian people rise to this challenge. I really believe in you guys. Please, Justin, help out the
artists. Justin, come on. Let's get Jen. Let's get her to Ottawa. Let's get her to Toronto. You know what? Justin, please just get Jen over here so we could have a glass of wine in person.
Justin, please, we just need to have some small hot apps and some time face to face.
I just want some tapas. Come on, man. Oh, Jen, on that note, I love you very much. Thank you so much for being on. Thank you for, you know what? We're going to see Torque next week, but honestly, you are the best.
I'm delighted that I really appreciate it. Thank you to the listeners for your forbearance with my, you know, academic speak and my bad jokes. And
no,
I'm excited to have Torque come back next week. He's great.
Oh, please. Yeah. Okay. So thank you so much, Jen. So we're going to kick it with, Nick Duckhart and, Marianne Torres. Nick, Marianne, how you guys doing?
Hi, we're hanging in there,
man.
So where are you at right now? Y'all in Miami?
Yes.
Yeah.
Kind of got weirdly stuck here because we always had plans to come here before COVID happened, and we had rented out our apartment. We were supposed to go on vacation. We rented out our apartment. I was supposed to be working in California. Nick was supposed to be on tour, and then everything shut down, and then we just stayed here.
Yep. Wow.
Yeah.
So like take me to the moment, because what's fascinating about the two of you is that, you know, it's one thing when one person has to go through this shit sandwich.
Yeah.
But the two of you, tell me both the positive and the negative of that. Is it, do you feel like you have like this support system with you all the time? Or does one of you look at the other person and say, man, I wish you were a lawyer? Like, how does this work?
Comes and goes. There are definitely moments where I'm like, I wish one of us had chosen to be a little more practical in our lives. But at the same time,
first of all, it started off as like a really good thing because, you know, Marianne was on the road with Wicked and I was obviously on the road with Come From Away. And, you know, we had spent so much time apart. So we were like, listen, I mean, this is not the best of circumstances, but at least we're getting to spend all this time together and to make up for lost time. But, right. You know, as this thing has progressed and as it's gotten just kind of progressively worse, we are now like, wow, this shit sandwich is really bad. And we have moments where we're really, really, you know, I mean, I'm always grateful I have her by my side, but there are moments where we're both struggling throughout the day. And we really are just like, man, I wish you were a lawyer, or I wish you were, you know, a doctor or whatever. But this is just unprecedented. You know, I don't think either one of us could have, or nobody in the world could have been prepared for this, you know?
Yeah, it's hard to, you know, I've been sort of like, I will admit to being the one that gets a little more freaked out about our work situation. And it's just, it's not like our lives had been, it's, what's funny is like, we weren't struggling artists. We were actually both working. So, right. You know, it's as if, you know, I mean, plenty of other people with, you know, non-arts related jobs have also lost their jobs and are also in the position we're in. I mean, we're being hit probably, you know, the worst along with the restaurant industry, but it's, yeah, I keep having to check myself because I keep wanting to go to that place of like, oh, I wish you were a lawyer, or I wish I had done something else. And then I have to sort of take it easy and be like, you know what? We were both succeeding in this industry. Mm-hmm. And this was just something that nobody could have prepared for. And it's like not, you know, quote, our fault because we chose this business, to be in the arts. Like, we were actually making a living, and we were proving that you can make a living, you know, not having to be like a, you know, a movie star. You could work as an artist and, you know, live a normal life and make a living and be comfortable. And then this happened. So I feel like I will take the heat in that. I think I've had a harder time with like, with our work situation and wishing that one of us was a lawyer.
I there's so much alignment there, Marianne. You know, just 2 days ago, I was watching that show, Indian Matchmaker on Netflix. Y'all should check that out. It's pretty, whatever. But, you know, so the girl or the guy is presented with like bio data of prospective kind of partners and proposals. And this one woman had these two bio datas. One was, he was a computer engineer, but he was a dancer and he was an artist and he was artistic and he looked really cool. And then this other guy, whatever, but he was a lawyer. And I was sitting there with my girlfriend, who loves me for who I am and is always appreciative of me. But I was like, oh, she's going to pick the computer engineer artist guy. He's so cool. And she's like, no, Allie, she's picking the lawyer. So, and lo and behold, Nadia picked the lawyer, and it triggered something in me. Yeah. Where all of a sudden I was like, I'm a nobody. I'm nobody now. Like,
dude, I've had multiple meltdowns of just being like, what have I been doing for the past 15 years of my life? Like, this has been everything I've been doing. And, you know, I have considered going back to school. And then I think, is that just like, if I go back to school or if I find another career, did I just throw away 15 years of my life? Like, it's gotten, you know, kind of dark.
Yeah, deep. You go deep. You go deep. Well, here's the thing, though, that I've come to realize just kind of yesterday was that I need to stop, you know, the limiting belief in my brain, and I think perhaps in all of us. Like, this is an artist advocacy podcast, and I think so many of us are going through the same shit.
Yeah.
But I need to, like, I need to stop telling myself that it was a mistake, because if I focus on the outcome, obviously the outcome was this, which was unlucky. Yeah. But if I think of the process, I said, you know what? I made subsequent really good decisions to get to where I was, before the moment that this happened. So I need to trust that good decisions are going to go forward. Exactly. And that's exactly what's that. Marianne, you had a tweet that I really loved, and I had like the clap, clap, clap between every word, but it was like arts jobs are real jobs or something like that. And that's something that, you know, I want to talk, I talk about a lot, but can you like tell me where that tweet came from? And Nick, please, like, can you please talk about how this is a job?
Well, yeah. Well, I just want to first of all say that I shared that tweet as a screenshot on my Instagram, and it got more likes than any picture that I've ever posted on the history of my Instagram. Just to start off with that. But yeah, no, I mean, I'm going to let Marianne talk about the tweet itself.
But yeah, basically what triggered me is that I was, you know, I kept posting information and asking people to sign petitions for the extension of the unemployment, the emergency.
The 600, yeah.
Yeah, the extra $600. You know, you can't live in New York with the minimum, with the unemployment. Yeah, with the max unemployment, you can't live in New York. So, you know, I was posting a lot about it and really advocating for it. And, you know, I, of course, had some trolls respond and say things like, stop asking for handouts and get a real job. And was really triggered by it. I mean, and then other people were like kind of doing like an all jobs matter to me, which was like so ridiculous.
Yeah.
I posted about it and somebody, you know, people were messaging me on Instagram and being like, you don't care about other people who lost their jobs. And I was like, dude, everybody would benefit from this. Yes. I'm not
for us.
It's not like I'm saying like only give this to artists who are out of work. I'm using my industry as an example because it's what I know and I'm going to advocate for my industry. I'm not like attacking restaurant, you know, people who work in the restaurant industry who are right now advocating for their industry and being like, well, theater people lost their jobs too. Like it doesn't have to be this thing. Like let's all advocate for ourselves and for each other. And it through that we advocate for other people too. Other people benefit from the $600.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I was very triggered by it and I shouldn't feed the trolls and I always respond and I
always tell Marianne, stop feeding the trolls.
Yeah. And then finally I just, it's like a constant battle with me because I'm like constantly just wanting to like make my point and be like, I am right. And you know, everybody benefits from the arts. Everybody enjoys the arts in some capacity. If you don't think they're real jobs, cancel your Netflix account.
Exactly.
Don't use a radio. Mm. Don't hire a wedding DJ. Don't hire a designer to design your wedding gown.
Don't wear clothes. Don't wear anything. You know,
if you really want to think about it, you know, the arts are in everything we do. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so that's what prompted my very popular tweet. And it was, I was like, oh, nobody ever likes this. I'm like not really like a social media influencer at all. And suddenly people like really
retweeting her stuff. No, but I, you know, and here's the thing too, is that, you know, we as artists, you know, and particularly, you know, particularly us as theater performers, I don't want to say particularly, but just from our experience, you know, we spend so much time validating our career choice or trying to, you know, prove to people that what we do is an actual job. Mm-hmm. You know, so much of the, you know, so many of the conversations we have are, okay, yeah, you're a theater actor, but what do you do for work? Right.
Like, oh God, I know.
That's a huge conversation. And it's just, it's getting to the point where, you know, first of all, if they, you know, could put themselves in our shoes and see that, like, you know, we've been able to actually, you know, make a living doing what we're doing and, you know, do it for as long as we've been doing
people
it.
People have families and lives just like that.
And in the case of this pandemic, you know, I mean, I think I speak for every theater artist when I say, you know, none of us are wanting to like, we understand why we can't go back to work. I mean, in a pandemic like this, we understand that, you know, until there's a vaccine, until we get the disease, the virus under control, you know, we understand why we can't go back to work, but we didn't choose to not go to work. We were told we can't go to work and we can't go to work because of this virus. So as long as we can't go to work, we are hoping that our governments will help us because we have no other option. You know, I think it's, and because we are being ignored, you know, as far as that's concerned, it's very frustrating. And that's why we're wanting to extend this extra $600 benefit. That way, not just us, but other careers who have no other option but not to go to work can, you know, keep themselves afloat. And once the economy reopens, they have two legs to stand on so they can be contributors to the economy once it opens up.
Mm. Do you think that, you know, they're the thing that I'm going through is really like deromanticizing what we do?
Yep.
Yes.
Do you feel though that we contributed to that a little bit? Do you think that's also part and parcel of our success to be like, yeah, it's a magic show? I always say like, if you know, when I bring, you know, when you bring people to rehearsal or you bring people on set and they're like, this is boring. It's like, yeah, it's fucking boring.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's work.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it definitely has shifted in me again and doing this for a long time. And I think, I mean, and I think all of us here know what it's like to, you know, do the same show for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I think that sort of deromanticizes it for you. I mean, it certainly did for me when you're just like, I'm just going to work and I still like my job, but it still work.
Yeah.
You know? And, but I mean, yeah, it's an interesting, I definitely, you know, I myself, I was guilty of saying things like, oh, I don't want to get a muggle job. I don't want a civilian job. You know what I mean? So I think we did sort of put our work. And here's the thing. It's that theater and performing arts is a thing that people do as a hobby. And I think people see us and think like, well, they just get to play for a living.
Right.
And
right.
It's fun and it can be really exciting and magical at times, but it also does require a lot of sacrifice and a lot of time. And like, we work 6 days a week, you know, we do a lot. It takes a lot out of our bodies. I mean, at one point while I was doing Wicked, I was like, I would come home and just like ice my neck, ice my knee, I was like in physical pain. And I mean, and that's nothing compared to what dancers go through. So it's definitely on us too to sort of like make people realize that it seems like an extraordinary job, but it's very much, you know, a normal, it's a thing we do every day. And yes, it's our responsibility to make it magical for the people who are seeing it for the first time in the audience, but we're just trying to make a living.
So right now in the US, I mean, Broadway's not opening until January. They say January 2021. Again, if there is a vaccine, and the push right now is for you guys, as you say, to extend the 600. I just read in the New York Times the Republicans are maybe going to reach a compromise to $400 up until December 31st.
Yes.
But that still, like here in Canada, we have that $2,000 a month that we've been receiving. But still, though, do you think that there's more that can be done? Because at the end of the day, a large percentage of us are just not going to be able to get back to do what we do. And have you thought of anything that can be done?
I mean, I think the other conversation to be had is, you know, if we can't go back to work as it once was, meaning as Broadway performers, if we can't go into the theater and do the show in front of an audience, how can we make our work available to people given the circumstances, right? And, you know, is there a conversation to be had as far as, you know, by utilizing technology or by doing that sort of thing, you know, how can we do that? But then I think ultimately once that conversation happens, I think, you know, I speak for the artists that I know, at least, that that doesn't seem like something that's viable and or
that's not what we do.
So
yeah.
So I mean, can we get more financial assistance? Of course we can, and we'd all be open to it. And I do think that, you know, ultimately, in order to, you know, the fear is that the economy will just go down the tank, and you know, we'd go, you know, maybe back to a Great Depression or something of that extreme. But ultimately, I think it is that in a crisis like this, we need the assistance of the government to make sure that everybody can have a, you know, a level playing field, if you will, for once the economy goes back to normal and we can all be contributors. And I think ultimately that's, you know, in the citizen life outside of the theater, I think that's the goal. But I don't know. What do you think, Marianne?
I think ultimately, I don't know. I'm not a policymaker. I don't work in government. I don't know that much. What I think should happen is communication.
That's a big one.
That's all I need. Like, I just want to feel heard and not dismissed, because I don't think there's any, I don't know. I'm honestly not on board with like virtual theater. For some instances, yes, but it's what we do is for the live experience. Yeah. That's what you want. And with virtual stuff, what I find is getting tricky is that like a lot of people just think that now they can ask you to work for free. And I just can't get on board with it, because it's like, well, you know, I'm not really asking that much of her. I'm just like having her turn on her computer and zing. And
right.
I absolutely not. So I, I think it's just as far as like the government doing anything for us and what else can be done. I think we just have to take it as a case by case basis. And the government has to realize how specific our case is. You know, New York might be in phase four, you know, starting phase four of reopening, but we're not even at phase one. Yeah. And that has to be taken into consideration. I would just like communication and compassion, really.
But Allie, I want to say that this goes hand in hand with what you're doing with the Arts New Deal, that, you know, I think there's something to be said or done or the conversation to be had, which is how can we make the government, our governments, our local governments, our national governments, get behind the arts as a human tool that will help us, that will help the citizens of the world, if you will, get through these times. Because I think what happens is right now what's happening is that the arts are being thrown away, or they're not even remotely being thought of. So, you know, I feel like we are suffering as a society, as a culture, because if we had more access and if our governments allowed the artists to go out and produce art, whether it's visual artists or musicians or theater performers, whatever, produce art in a way that at least while this is happening, while we are in this turning point or in this moment of our lives, we have this beautiful form of expression to hold on to. I think that that's something that we should be having a conversation about, or, you know, just something like that, where we don't lose track of how important the arts actually are to society.
What makes me really sad about particularly, you know, the predicament of the United States was what inspired the, you know, the Arts New Deal that we're trying to push here in Canada was the Works Progress Administration of the Roosevelt administration in the United States.
Right.
And particularly reading about what that did to America and what it did to culture and how it pushed it. I read the other day that Orson Welles was commissioned before he was Orson Welles through the WPA to do an all-black version of Macbeth. Langston Hughes was commissioned through the WPA. Arthur Miller, before he was Arthur Miller, was commissioned. Mark Rothko, Jackson Pollock. So right now you kind of see all this stuff going here, what's going down right now, and you wonder how many Arthur Millers, how many Langston Hughes, how many Jackson Pollocks are sitting and not working.
Right.
Yeah. And this goes to this other question I want to ask you guys in general, because I'm just trying to get an understanding from artists everywhere. It's, you know, one, there's two movements right now happening in Canada. One movement is a continuation of the CERB, basically the $2,000 a month. Mm-hmm. And then there's the Arts New Deal, which is, you know, for artists, basically a jobs bill.
Uh-huh.
Do you guys find, because I find this myself personally, that I work better when there's money involved?
I mean,
and like, do you know what I mean? Like, if I just gave you guys cash and said, just whatever, would you, you know, how does your artistry work? Because for me, it's like, you know what? I'd rather be commissioned.
I mean, listen, you know, if I said that, you know, we only did things for the art, I would be lying, right? I mean, listen, you know, the art and what we do is 50% of why we do what we do, or even more, because we love what we do. But, you know, we are, We are professionals.
You need incentive. I think the thing with money, it's being commissioned. It's like somebody saying, here, I see you, I appreciate your work, and I value it and I respect it. And I think it's easier to find, you know what I mean, to then sort of tap into some really good shit. Just like, you know, doing it and trying to survive and begging, knowing that, like, here's our attention, here is our money, we value you.
Yeah.
I think it's really important.
Absolutely.
I mean, so I find that I work better under those circumstances too. I mean, and even in it's, you know, we ask when we negotiate a contract, when we're, you know, just for something like if you're negotiating a contract to do a show, you ask for more money, and sometimes it's about feeling like you are appreciated, mm-hmm. and like you are, if somebody feels like your work is valued and valuable.
And I really think that's where, because I have the same sentiment as you, Marianne, where I was like, even Torkel talked about this. he was like, you know, stop giving it away for free. Stop giving it away for free because you devalue it. And if everybody starts giving it away for free, then everyone's just doing TikTok. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
I agree. Well, and that's what was happening in the beginning of this. And I was getting really frustrated. In the beginning of quarantine and everything, you know, and there was a lot of giving it away for free.
Yeah.
And I get it. I think we were all sort of, people were really hungry to do something.
Mm-hmm.
But I was like, this is just, it's just perpetuating this idea that like, that art should be free. And that's bullshit. Like, I was basically yelling at my Instagram every day thinking, don't stop giving it away for free. Stop it. Because then people are going to expect me to do the same. And then it puts you in a weird place too, because then when somebody does approach you about something,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know if you've ever felt this way. You feel like an asshole for asking about pay.
Oh,
you know, like if somebody just says like, oh, hey, I wrote this song and I was wondering if you could record this for me or something, or do this reading. And they don't bring up money.
Yeah.
Then you're like,
I feel like an ass.
That wouldn't happen in any other profession. Any other profession.
Right. Exactly.
Well, it's like there's the running joke is, but this is really great exposure for you, and you go, oh, well, that's so great. My rent is 6,000 exposure.
So yeah, it's just bullshit. Yeah. So I mean, I definitely think money. Yeah, money plays a. It's important. It's we all.
We're all little, you know, we're in the capitalistic society, but you know what? Screw that. Even if you go back, you know, the Sistine Chapel was painted on a commission as well, too. Yeah, it wasn't just pure joy.
Right.
So,
And every other industry, every other profession, you think, you know what? You are capable of doing this thing that I cannot do. You deserve to be compensated for it.
Correct.
And I think the same, you know, it should be the same for artists.
What?
Boom.
Yeah.
Go on, Nick.
No, I was going to say one thing that I've found too is the, you know, those who are saying to us artists during this time, you know, get a real job or something like that, they're also the first ones who will pay money to come see us in the show, right? So
I know
that's a whole other conversation right there.
So once this is like done, let's say I call it V+1, vaccine day +1, like real talk, you know, Nick, I'll ask you, Marianne, I'll ask you, do you think, for me, it's weird. I think about that world and I see it as like a completely different world.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think like, how have you guys changed? And do you think you guys can just jump back into what it was? How do you guys feel?
I mean, listen, you know, if we have changed, I would say the biggest change that we've had is that we realize that maybe we can't put all our eggs in our performer basket, I guess, and maybe in trying to find other ways to, you know, find other interests, other careers, that sort of thing, just so that we can have a safety net. Now, I mean, let me kind of backtrack. You know how like sometimes when you're younger and you tell your family that you want to be a performer, they go, okay, but do you have like a backup plan? And I used to, you know, I used to stubbornly say, absolutely not. I'm going to be a performer. It is what it is. So, you know, but now I think this has put us in a bit of a crisis mode and it, you know, it kind of puts things into perspective. Now I'm very lucky in the sense that like the Come From Away team has really had our backs and has supported us and has said, you know, up to today, you know, it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. So, you know, I feel very blessed and very lucky to have that safety, if you will, or that peace of mind, but there's still a little bit of, okay, you know, God forbid something like this were to happen again. You know, I want to make sure that for the sake of our future family or, you know, for ourselves as a couple that we can put our,
what are you announcing on this podcast?
Nothing yet. I realize that's why I caught myself. don't worry. We're not announcing anything. No, but the idea that just, you know, we can protect ourselves in the case of something like this were to happen again, I think that's maybe the biggest change to our mindset.
I mean, I don't know. It's definitely, I mean, listen, I right before we got on here, I was looking at graduate school options.
cool.
But I'm still not, and in terms of, I mean, I think your question is specifically in going back into this business and going back into the industry. I think some changes are for the better in terms of my perspective. I will admit to taking it for granted, you know, mm-hmm. the fact that I had been working so long at theater, I was kind of taking it for granted, and it just, you know, felt like a regular job to me sometimes. And I think going back to it, whenever it does go back, it will feel wonderful. And I will try my hardest to never take it for granted again. I think it shifted something in the way I'm going to approach my career. Because, and it's not about like having, like not having the same goals or like aiming for less, I guess, but it's like, I have a feeling the business is going to change in the way shows are cast, in the size of shows, right? At least for the immediate, you know, at least for a few years. And I think a lot of things are going to be produced, you know, that are, you know, heavily, like, you know, smaller and like, you know, big name stars, things to get people into the seats. That may not be the case, but that's sort of what I'm assuming, because the one thing that this has done is even the playing field for all of us. Just like we're out of work, you know, Audra McDonald is out of work. So I feel like I might have a different approach. You know, in the past few years, I had been sort of trying to transition in my career from, you know, understudying and stuff to, you know, trying to advocate for myself to be cast in lead roles and stuff like that. Right. And I'm sort of like, I'm okay with taking a step back from that if it means having a job. And it doesn't, I'm not in any way shitting on being a cover or under, I mean, again, it's how I have made my career. I was just hoping to transition from that. And that perspective has shifted a little bit. And I'm like, you know what? I would like to work in this industry. And also maybe go to graduate school.
And to study what? To study what?
I'm looking into psychology programs right now.
Yeah. Sweet.
Yeah.
Nick, you're going to be client hours, buddy.
That's right. That's right. No, listen, I'm also a licensed realtor in New York, so I'll be able to go back to that, which is good.
Oh, great.
Yeah. But, you know, and Ali, I was thinking about this too. I mean, you know, one of the things I think we're all just looking forward to is that first day that Broadway or, you know, theater opens up again, just what a relief it's going to be, you know, in the sense that, you know, and like, for you know this feeling, you know, as soon as that boom, 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 boom,
oh, boom yeah.
starts, I mean, oh my God, I think about that moment and what that's going to be like. And I just, I want to cry. Like, I can't wait for that to happen again. And once we can, man, once we can get back in a theater with an audience, it's going to be so special.
Can I also say that something that a change that I'm actually looking forward to is, as we all know, in the middle of this pandemic has also, you know, another basically civil rights movement been fired up. And, you know, theater makers have to listen. Like, yes. I think when we go back, change has to be made in terms of the, you know, power structure and casting and everything in theater, and to be more inclusive. And I'm looking forward to that. I'm looking forward to hopefully, you know, more works that were written by people of color being produced, and, you know, so, you know, and more, you know, directors who are, you know, of color and people in management positions. So I do think that something, you know, something really great could also come from all of this, because this is giving people the time. They have to think about it. They have to have these conversations. And now I think it's like, if you don't do anything, to change what, you know, what has been a very, very predominantly white industry, then, you know, we won't be able to overlook that. Like, it will feel very deliberate and irresponsible, frankly.
That is definitely going to be a good outcome of this. And in a weird way, we have to be honest, you know, when we come back, and obviously it is when, there are going to be a lot of theaters that are empty. I think there's like 40 some odd theaters on Broadway. And prior to this, obviously they were all packed and it was very difficult to get a spot. But now they're going to be empty, and you always wonder, like, okay, so there's openings now in a way for perhaps more independent and more risky voices and more diverse voices. you two, prior to this, were both on tour. You guys wouldn't see each other. You'd be in different time zones. Mm-hmm. You would meet, and we would all see how lovingly beautiful the meet, seeing each other again on Instagram was, and it was really lovely. And then the dog and your amazing dog. By the way, like, is your dog like weird? My dog has no idea what's going on, seeing me all the time. It like freaks him out.
Yeah, you know, but she's like loving all the extra walks, but she's definitely needs some space from us sometimes.
Yeah. No. Although, yes. Although right now she's literally sitting right in between us. Yes. She we had to take her collar off
because she.
Oh, I love it.
So if you hear jingling, it was Lucy's collar, and yeah, we had to take it off because she was demanding our attention.
but like, so what have y'all like in this time, you know, personal question, but whatever, what, like, have you guys learned anything new about each other?
I mean,
we've seen each other and like this really crazy, obviously we're married and we've been together a while, so we've seen each other in vulnerable places, you know, but I think we've just learned. God, that's like such an intense question because I know that we have, and it's like so.
Well, I will say, like, the one thing that I think I've learned about, it's not just of Marianne, but myself too, is how we handle crisis ourselves and how we handle crisis as the spouse of the person who is going through crisis. Right. Does that make sense? Like, that's the big, that is like. Like, I know, like, when I'm freaking out, like, oh my God, I'm handling this sort of freak out in a way that I never thought I could handle it.
Freaking the fuck out.
Like,
if
literally,
you
fuck out, Allie, freaking the fuck out.
What's that? I forgot everything.
That's right. I think there's a clap in there too. And then also just, you know, when Marianne is having a moment, and how I am able to assist her or not able to assist her. That's something that, you know, we learn about ourselves that I want to work on as her husband. I mean, there are also like daily things that we learn about each other that like, just like, oh, okay, that's how you do that. Okay, cool. Yeah. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, definitely just, you know, crisis management. It's a constant give and take. Like, it's literally, every couple weeks, one of us is having a really bad moment and like, how are we going to react and what do we need? And it just, you know, it's a lot of communication and a lot of like learning not to take things personally, I think. And we're both pretty sensitive people. So I think we both have really had to learn to not take shit personally.
Yeah.
You know, because this is so hard right now, like, and that like, I think we've really learned because so much of the last year of our relationship was long distance. Whenever we were together, it was like a little vacation, and it was really fun, and it was like constant togetherness. And like, we're both, and I think this is a good thing, is that we're both really good at respecting each other's space and time. Like, if I need to go lock myself in a room and he needs to go lock himself in a room, and it doesn't mean we're mad at each other, but we just like need to be alone, it's totally fine. And it's learning sort of how to give each other space and not take things personally, because this is just a really hard time.
Yep.
Yeah. Listen, I want to thank you guys for being on. You know, what's really shitty though about this conversation, it's like, I just like, sometimes you have really nice conversations on the phone or Zoom, or in this case, using this podcast apparatus, but you go, damn, I kind of wish, you know, the two of us and our dogs were hanging out in my apartment drinking some wine right now. Like, that would be.
Seriously. I wish we could do that too, man.
I can't guarantee.
2024, baby. That's what I say.
I can't guarantee Lucy would be nice to your dog, but one can.
Whatever. No, you know what? Rumi loves the ladies, so he'll figure it out.
Dudley, so, you know.
Yeah, you know. Yeah. Listen, but so obviously, you know, because we believe in art on this show, and we believe art gets people through, like, what art is getting you guys through? Is there any, like, books or albums or movies or TV shows?
I mean, we've been binging all the things from art to absolute garbage.
Yeah.
Give me an art pick and a garbage pick.
We just watched, I do not condone bootlegs of shows, but Desperate Times. We just watched a bootleg of the original cast of Once.
Once.
And it really just fed my soul. Like, it just was like, oh, this is everything I love about theater. And it was, I don't know, for me, that was a big one.
Yeah.
What TV we watched a movie that was really good with Kristen Milioti.
Kristen Milioti, yeah, Palm Springs. That was a great movie. We're big Office fans in this house too. So we just watched The Office over and over and over and over again.
Yeah, Dwight Schrute always comes through.
You don't like to admit this, but you like Keeping Up with the Kardashians.
When was the last time I watched that? It's been years.
It's been a very long time.
It's been years.
I give her a hard time.
He's trying to embarrass me. It's been years. But we have been watching a lot of 90 Day Fiancé.
90 Day Fiancé. That's our big
90 Day Fiancé before the 90 days, yeah, baby.
All of them.
God, it's such a disaster.
Even the spinoffs like Family Chantal and all that stuff. We've done all the stuff, man.
Yeah.
It's the number one, supposedly 90 Day Fiancé before the 90 days is like the number one show in America.
Really?
Yeah, supposedly, like on TV. But I'll never forget my favorite line of anything I've ever heard in my life was, after 7 years and 5 failed attempts, I'm finally going to see my Anya. That line to me, I was like, I couldn't even write that. That's amazing.
I mean, listen, that show, it doesn't surprise me that it's the number one show. It is glorious trash. I mean, it really is.
It's so, I don't know what it is. It's just, you can't stop. You really can't.
Can't stop, so invested.
It's so bad.
You get in.
You do.
You can't stop that, but we're gonna put a stop to this incredible interview because otherwise we're gonna be here for like an hour just talking shit. So, but listen, Nick,
yeah.
Marianne, thank you guys so much, and honestly, sending love to you, sending love to Florida.
Yeah,
you know, Florida needs it. And Trump 2020. I'm kidding. Not Trump.
No.
I was about to wish you well and wish you luck. take it all back.
Oh, thank you guys so much for being on. And honestly, just like all the love.
Back at you, man. Thank you so much for having us on.
Nick Duckhart, Marianne Torres, thank you guys so much. You guys are incredible. And when we left, I told them that they need to have a podcast because I would love to listen to them talk. And just the bubble of their love every single week. I would definitely listen to that. So you know what? Watch out. I think they're going to make a podcast. And I think that would be good for my soul and the soul of so many others. So that's that. That's Soft Revolution. Jen, Lena, thank you again. You are officially, you know what? This is now Soft Revolution with Torkel Campbell, Ali Momin, and Jennifer Lena. That's what this is. We are updating everything. No, but seriously, thank you so much. You are incredible. I want to thank everybody who listens to this show. It really, really means a lot to us that you do every single week. It means a lot. I want to thank all our Patreon members. And for those of us, for those of you who don't know, you can sign up for our Patreon. You get the episode a day early. You get access to a bonus episode. You get access to basically us. You know, you could message us and we always respond back. So you get that. You get a discussion board. It's really good. And when the day comes that we could all convene, you guys get first access to a live taping with Torkel and I. And that'd be great. So please go find us on Patreon, patreon.com/softrevolution, and check us out. And really, it's like the price of a coffee every single month. And if you can do that, you know, we'd really appreciate it. And if not, it's all good. We love you anyways. So that's that. We'll see you next week. Torkel will be back. Fortunately, unfortunately, I'll let you decide. Fortunately for me, definitely, because he is the man and I miss him. So my art pick for the week, I'm playing it right now. It's Coffee, the amazing reggae singer Coffee. She's written the first and I would say probably only hype song about quarantine. The song is called Lockdown, and I hope y'all enjoy it. Love to you all. See you next week. Torque is back, and I miss him. All right. So love to you all. This is Coffee, Lockdown. You guys are the best. We'll see you next week on Soft Revolution. No vacancy. Last time, see you on FaceTime. Chatting up the place, boating on my relationship. Me, I go put you on lockdown. I put your body on lockdown. You got me on lock now. You got my person on lock. Oh, if you love me, you should let me. You should let me. You should let me know. And if you don't know.
up, pulling up, pulling up. Nobody deal with the bugger and talking. Me nothing now, we are chilling in the apartment. Hope you don't mind me asking, where will we go? When the quarantine thing done and everybody touch road. Mommy, me gonna start, pull up in a fast car, yeah. I know fast start, make you want the fast part, yeah. I know you're feeling me. You know I'm feeling you. So what now we for do, yeah.
Say you want travel, we go whole valley. Say you hope in your love and not just no tally. Make my heart full of some, I love you totally. Do my own thing, I'm in a trouble, nobody.
I'm watching out for the patio. And they did the nearby, them I watch me now. Swing on me, no miss like Pacquiao. What you feeling for hot coffee, yo? What you know, what you know? All you want up, but how much your money? Yeah, anything you want, coffee got the money. Yeah, me give you my heart, make you take it from me. Where will we go? Feeling you, baby, are you feeling me? Cause I'm really feeling you. I'ma pull up in my fast car.
Pull up in my fast car.